You?
Sure.
Farsight's cafeteria was nothing more than another man-made cave, carved into the lunar rock with plasma torches. It was a dismally small, square chamber. McClintock felt as if its low ceilings were squeezing down on him. Two of the cafeteria's walls were lined with food and drink dispensing machines. The plastic-tiled floor was covered by three rows of long tables and hard, uncomfortable benches. No one can accuse Ulrich of wasting money on luxuries, McClintock thought. The place was empty when they entered it. Good, thought McClintock. Nothing worse than having to eat cheek by jowl with a gang of these techie bores. Trudy followed him like a puppy as he selected a sandwich that purported to be soy burger and lettuce grown in Cellini's hydroponics farm. The drink selection was limited to lunar water, fruit juices, and ersatz coffee or tea that McClintock suspected would be miserably weak. The limited fare didn't seem to bother Trudy at all. She picked a limp salad, a bowl of fresh berries, and a glass of tea. As they sat side by side at one of the long empty tables, McClintock muttered, "I'll have to take you to a real restaurant one of these days." She fairly glowed.
"Like the Earth View? Over at Cellini?"
"Have you been there?"
"No, but I heard about it. Saw it in the orientation vid."
He nodded, then took a bite of his flavorless burger.
"You're not happy here?"
Trudy asked, picking at her salad. "Be careful," McClintock warned himself. "Choose your words prudently." He gave her a forlorn look. "I feel as if I'm in some frontier outpost, far from civilization."
"Well, you are," she said.
With a faint smile, he admitted, "I guess I am."
"Why'd you come here if you don't like the place?"
Trudy asked. "Oh, family responsibilities."
"Really?"
"You see, in my family, one is expected to do some form of public service before one can inherit his share of the family fortune." Her eyes went wide.
"Fortune?"
"The McClintock clan is quite wealthy," he explained, "but very stern. My great-grandfather was apparently afraid that inheriting great wealth would turn his progeny into wastrels. So he made it a provision of his will that every one of us has to work at least 2 years in public service before we could inherit." Trudy chewed thoughtfully on her greens for a few heartbeats. Then,
"There's a lot of public service to be done, isn't there? I mean, with the greenhouse floods and the droughts and all those monstrous storms and everything. Lots of people need help."
McClintock got a mental picture of the massive waves of miserable migrants, poor, starving, trekking across the land seeking a job, a living, some hope for the future, a spark of opportunity for their crying, squalling, sick and frail children. He shuddered. "I decided to do my public service here on the moon," he said, stretching the truth considerably. "My goal is to help humankind to extend its habitat beyond the Earth." "Quite lofty, don't you think?" Trudy nodded, wordless. He failed to mention what his real goal was. Instead, he asked her, "And what brings you to Farsight?"
"Sirius C, of course," she said.
"Of course." Almost quivering with eagerness, Trudy enthused,
"I mean, it's the biggest thing to hit astronomy since Hubble discovered the red shift."
McClintock suppressed an impulse to ask what she meant by that.
"You see," she went on, "the planet shouldn't be there at all. The pup blew up eons ago, and..."
"The pup?" She bobbed her head up and down.
"Sirius has been called the dog star since ancient times. It's the brightest star in the constellation Canis Major, the big dog."
"I see," McClintock said.
"Well, when its dwarf companion was discovered back in the 19th century, naturally people started calling it the pup."
"And it blew up?"
"Nova," she replied. "Probably blew off its outer shell more than once."
"I see," he repeated.
"Which makes it hard to believe there's an Earth-like planet in the Sirius system. It would have been fried by those Nova burps, boiled down to a cinder. An Earth-sized planet is hard enough to believe, but it can't possibly be Earth-like."
"Yet there it is," McClintock murmured, "and Ulrich is hell-bent to get imagery of it."
"You know," Trudy went on, "the first extrasolar planets ever discovered were orbiting around a pulsar. That's a star that underwent a supernova explosion. Nothing left of the original star except a tiny core, smaller than Earth. And yet there were a couple of planets around it."
"The planets should have been destroyed in the explosion?"
Nodding again, Trudy said, "But they weren't. Or maybe they formed out of the debris cloud after the supernova popped.
She jabbed her fork into the salad again.
We've got a lot to learn.
Yes, I suppose we do. But McClintock's mind wasn't on astronomy. He was wondering if this little waif of a woman might go to bed with him, without screaming for a lawyer afterward. Dossier, Carter Nelson McClintock. From those to whom much is given, much is expected. Carter McClintock had heard that old saw all his life, and he hated it. The McClintock clan had made its fortune originally in whaling. During the Civil War, when President Lincoln created the National Academy of Sciences, a McClintock was named to its directing committee. He was clever enough to invest in railroads, and his son was even cleverer. He got the family out of railroads and into chemicals. McClintock money helped to finance the Spanish-American War, and the family profited greatly from the growth of the munitions industry. World War I was a bonanza. By then, one of the McClintock boys was backing the fledgling aviation industry. While barnstormers and explorers were killing themselves pushing the envelope of aviation technology, McClintock investments financed the fledgling commercial airlines. One of the McClintocks lost billions when the dot-com bubble burst in the 1990s, but his brothers and cousins bailed him out with money they had made in energy, transportation, and real estate. In the early years of the 21st century, it was a McClintock partnership with the Masterson family that allowed the ill-starred Masterson clan to make commercial spaceflight profitable. The onset of the catastrophic climate shift that wrecked the lives of hundreds of millions brought new opportunity for the family. Carter McClintock's father quoted Andrew Carnegie's dictum, "It's a valuable citizen who has money during a panic," as he poured billions into nuclear fusion power generation and solar power satellites. Young Carter was more interested in fine art than finance. He raised funds to protect the city of Venice from being inundated by the rising Adriatic Sea. He salvaged the Acropolis Reclamation Project when the European Union reneged on its commitment because of all the other demands on its resources, stretched to the breaking point by the hordes of refugees fleeing their flooded homelands. Almost single-handedly, he saved the ancient temples of Cambodia from the mobs of squatters who had moved into them. Carter had no interest in space. The activities of high-tech nerds in strange and dangerous places bored him, or so he told himself. Actually, those strange and dangerous places frightened him. Floating around in weightlessness? Walking on the dead and deadly surface of the moon? Spending months in a coffin-like spacecraft heading to Mars? No, thank you. Carter preferred Earth, battered by the greenhouse shift, though it may be. Inevitably, he clashed with his father. "Space is where the action is, boy," the elder McClintock insisted. "It's the frontier now, and the frontier is where new fortunes are made." Carter was quite content with the family's existing fortune. He had no desire to enlarge it. Let his father and brothers see to that. He wanted to spend the family's money on worthy causes. He wanted to be admired by the people who meant something to him, people of status, of taste, of cultivation. Yet his father persisted. When Professor Jason Ulrich of Cellini University visited Philadelphia as part of his effort to raise money for his cherished Far Side Observatory project, the elder McClintock invited the abstemious professor into his home for a quiet little dinner and chat. At first, Ulrich struck Carter McClintock as a man of the old world, cultured, well-mannered, obsequious in the presence of enormous wealth. But once the astronomer began to talk about his dream of an observatory on the moon, Carter saw that the man was just another techie fanatic, so narrowly focused on his arcane goal that nothing else mattered to him. Yet Carter's father was fascinated by Ulrich and his hope of beating the IAA to be the first to acquire visual imagery of New Earth. To Carter's stunned consternation, his father suggested that he might help finance the observatory with funds from the McClintock Trust. "Why?" Carter asked his father, once Professor Ulrich had finished bowing and scraping and had left their home. "Why on earth would you—" "It's not on earth," his father said, beaming happily from behind his thick gray mustache. "It's on the moon. The far side of the moon at that."